I want to see science serve a useful purpose to improve the standard of living for all people.
Hey, why is anyone fighting food advance? A very small percentage of the world's population is fortunate enough to have the luxury of turning down food.
We've arranged a society based on science and technology in which nobody understands anything about science and technology.
You can't build a peaceful world on empty stomachs and human misery.
You're listening to Talking Biotech, a weekly podcast illuminating issues in agricultural and medical biotechnology. Your questions and concerns are addressed using a science-based approach with the goal of driving discovery to application with communication. Now here's your host, Dr. Kevin Folker.
And welcome to the Talking Biotech Podcast. It's the weekly podcast where we discuss contemporary issues in science and technology with a focus on biotechnology and new innovations that can help people and help the planet.
And today we go to Paris, France, where we're speaking with Professor Eva Maria Geigel, who is a paleogeneticist who recently published information about the domestication of cats. Welcome to the podcast, Professor Geigel.
Hello.
And you're at the Jacques Monod National Research Center in Paris, or in France. It's a national research laboratory in France, correct?
Yes, it is an institute of molecular and cellular biology belonging to the French National Research Center, the CNRS, which is a center that encompasses all scientific domains and fields.
And your work in particular has been as a paleogeneticist. Are some of the more intriguing discoveries and intriguing jobs out there because you're piecing things together from biological molecules, from DNA evidence in some cases, in many cases, that is sometimes coming from maybe preserved specimens or, in this case, mummies when we talk about cats. Is this becoming a bigger area with time?
Yes, it became a big area with the... But when genomics actually took off, so since we are able to sequence whole genomes, and this is also possible through these new techniques to do in some cases in ancient calcified tissues from organisms that have lived in the past, so this was really a new field.
But an area that was ready to explode once the technology was there to support it, right? I mean, it's great questions. And when I think about this particular area, I think this is the area I would have gone into.
So the field of paleogenetics is around 30 years old, but genomics we are doing since, not even 10 years. I think I would say the first real genome was published in 2010. This was the Neanderthal genome.
Yes, and that one's pretty exciting. And I think about that and what's been done from the mammoth. What are some other really interesting ancient ones that have come from old specimens?
I would say the whole peopling history of Eurasia and also America and Australia has been reconstructed through ancient genomes now. We have an amazing knowledge how the peopling of the continents happened over the last, let's say, 20,000 years or 30,000 years. So this is maybe the area that is the most exciting for the great public, for them. But also domestication is also a very interesting area. Well, humans are very self-centered, so everything that has to do with humans is much more interesting than if you just analyze ancient populations of animals or plants that are not related to humans. For example, we also study ancient populations that responded to climate change, but this was not related to humans, so there is a little less interest of the large public, I would say.
Well, the other really interesting edge of this that relates to your current research comes from the domestication of animals that really were happening, was happening at the same time that humans were radiating and changing through time. They were doing this in concert with dogs and cats and some of our other domesticated animals. The paper that was discussed in June of 2017 really focused upon cats and their coming into contact with humans and how they changed through time. But how did that really occur? I mean, I think about cats, I think of the large felines and then maybe the small cats. How related are they really, and when did those divergences really happen?
Well, the large cats are related. It's a family. It's a big group of animals. But we did our studies on the small cat that gave the domestic cat. So we studied wild cats and domestic cats. Wild cats are a specific species, which is Felis silvestris, and there are 5 subspecies that are in Europe, in Asia, and in Africa. And only one of the subspecies, the one from Northern Africa and Southwest Asia, was domesticated and is the ancestor of all domestic cats that we have all around the world nowadays.
So can some of those domestic cats be traced back to either the Asian or the African subspecies, or were they really more from one or the other?
Well, this is actually what we found through our study. So what we found was that we looked at the what we call phylogeography, so the pattern, the population structure of wild cats before the Neolithic. Neolithic is the time when humans in the Fertile Crescent in the Middle East started to do farming and to domesticate animals. So before this time, we wanted to know how were the wild cats in the different areas so that we would see how this maybe changed through domestication. And so we found that in Europe, there was in the West the European wild cat, mm-hmm. and in Southwest Asia, there was the Libica, Felis silvestris libica, another subspecies of the wild cat that was endemic in this area.
And what do we know about the ways that humans first came in contact with cats, or that they came in contact with us?
Then, with the onset of the Neolithic, with when the people started to do agriculture, and the first farmers migrated out of Anatolia into Europe, this happened around 7,000 years ago, we see this Anatolian wild cat or cat, we don't know how, whether it was wild or not now, this cat from Anatolia popping up in archaeological sites that belong to these first farmers that colonized Europe. So from this we can deduce that the cat at this time came closer to human settlements, because humans started to do agriculture to accumulate grains, and these grains of course attracted rodents, and so cats that were hungry saw these rodents and came closer to the settlements where these grain accumulations were and fed on the rodents. And these were the cats probably that were the least shy and those who were inclined to tolerate humans and other cats, because you have to know that the wild cat is a solitary animal that does not look for humans and does not look for other cats, but rather lives as completely alone, at least when it's not mating and when it's not, the females when they have the youngs are of course with the kittens. But apart from this period, they live alone. And so those cats that changed a little bit their behavior became tamed and lived together with humans. And so also migrated with humans on their trips, their migrations into other areas, which they started about 7,000 years ago. This, of course, we deduce that from what we know from archaeological the archaeological knowledge, the context, and what we know, what we saw in our data, where we analyzed a genetic marker that tells us the lineage, the maternal lineage that the cat belonged to. So we could distinguish the European cat from these Southwest Asian and Northeast African wild cat, and we could see that this cat started to move around when humans started to move around. And so later, so this was the Southwest Asian cat before, and then we also analyzed more recent bones and mummies from Egypt, and there was another type, mitochondrial type, so another genetic type, lineage, that we had not seen in other areas. So, and this Egyptian cat or Egyptian lineage, in the centuries that followed our discovery, so from these mummies that belonged to the Ptolemaic period, in later periods during the Roman periods in Anatolia and then in Iran and in the Levant and in Europe and later in the Middle Ages in Viking sites, this Egyptian cat appears in the archaeological sites and appears at a high number, at a number that is so high that the local cat, the Anatolian cat, for example, it was 50-50. So we have about 50% Anatolian lineage and 50% Egyptian lineage. So the Egyptian cat bred over the ancient world because probably, and this we deduce now from the historical context, that these cats were boarded the ships and were shipped around with the seafarers. With the seafarers that were merchants and traders and raiders and soldiers. And so they conquered the world together with these seafarers.
You mentioned talking about cats in Egypt and cats that were mummified. How frequent was it that you would find a mummified cat? Or why did the Egyptians mummify them to begin with?
The cat had a very special position in the Egyptian society. Already in the 2000 BC, we have in the iconography of Egypt, we see the cat. We see the cat in the marshes hunting with humans. We see the cat slaughtering the snake that is threatening the sun god Ra, so helping the sun to rise again in the morning. So it became a goddess, became a divine animal, and was extremely important to the ancient Egyptian society. So most of the mummified cats come from the Ptolemaic period, where more and more cats were mummified, and there were millions of cats. Actually, so many mummified cats were found in the 19th century that the English took them to England and made fertilizer out of it.
It seems like a rather anticlimactic end to finding these, you know, artifactual mummified cats. It would seem like they would have some better purpose than fertilizer.
Yeah, well, but there were millions. And so at the time, since there were so many, they just used them as fertilizers. Of course, nowadays they are precious, and so they are kept in museums. And when they come up in a new excavation from a tomb, of course they are kept then probably kept in Egypt anyway, because Egypt doesn't let any archaeological material leave the country anymore. But the mummified cats that are now in the museums in Europe and in America and elsewhere in the world, they are well kept, of course.
Now, I've worked with DNA for decades, and I know it's a fairly resilient molecule, but you're talking about something that's been basically fossilized. How hard is it to work with this ancient DNA?
It is not easy to analyze ancient DNA. Ancient DNA is very quickly and very profoundly degraded after the death of an animal or of a human. Immediately after death, the degradation process starts, and DNA gets heavily degraded. It remains only if something remains after hundreds of years or thousands of years. It's very, very little, So the quantity is very low and the DNA fragments are very short. So it is a technical challenge to analyze this DNA. And the hotter the climate is in which the skeletal remains are preserved, the less DNA is preserved. And Egypt is very hot. So in Egypt, normally DNA is extremely poorly preserved. So we analyzed almost 80 cats, 80 mummies, and only 5 or 6 gave results. So all the others did not have DNA anymore in the part that we analyzed together with Claudio Ottoni, who is the first author on our study. So we have real problems in this area, also in the Levant, in Syria, so in these hot countries that are extremely interesting to analyze, because our society started to be constructed in this area. You know, agriculture and domestication started in the Fertile Crescent, which is the north of Syria, the southeast of Turkey, down to the Iraq, and so the Mesopotamia, and then also Egypt. And these are all very hot areas. But it would be extremely interesting to analyze all the bones from these various domestic animals and wild animals and for humans. We now recently, our community found out that there is one particular bone, which is the petrous bone, which is the bone that protects the inner ear, that is extremely dense and where DNA is well preserved. So there the chance to get some DNA is higher. But we did not have a single one of those because cat remains are scarce. So it's rare to find cat in archaeological sites. Why? Because, as I said already at the beginning, in paleontological sites you do not find it because it's a solitary animal. So when it dies, it will, and it's a small animal, when it dies, you will not find the bones. In archaeological sites, which are the sites of human occupation, you find the refuse of human nutrition, so the animals that were eaten. The cat was not really eaten. It was never a subsistence animal. It might have been eaten occasionally, but it was certainly not hunted to be eaten. It was not maybe sometimes by accident hunted for the fur, but it was certainly not an animal that was accumulated in archaeological sites so that you find a lot of bones. So you find then with time, as the cat became tamer and entered the human niche and lived with the human, with human in the settlements, you find more and more bones. But the bones are small, they are fragile, DNA is not very well preserved in general, and we did not have a single of these precious petrous bones that would have given us much more DNA information as we had could obtain so far.
Well, this is a good spot to take a break today. We're talking with Professor Eva Maria Geigel from the University of Paris at Diderot, which is the Jacques Monod Institute, Jacques Monod being one of the founders of the Lac Operon, for those of you who know that stuff. We'll be right back with the Talking Biotech Podcast.
The Talking Biotech Podcast is approaching a podcast milestone, the 100th episode. The reviews are energizing and the wide listenership spurs us on to continue to produce improved and compelling podcast material into the next 100 episodes. At this rate, we're projected to reach the 1000th episode in November of 2034. Now, based on your emails, the 100th episode will be an interview with Dr. Kevin Folta, the originator and one of the Talking Biotech hosts. If you have questions, please mail them to talkingbiotech@gmail.com or submit them on Twitter at @talkingbiotech. The special episode will be hosted by Chris Barbie. Most of all, thank you for listening. Thank you for telling a friend and helping us share the wonderful stories of science that can help people and help the planet.
And we're back on the Talking Biotech podcast, today talking with Professor Ava Maria Geigel, a paleogeneticist who's using DNA evidence to identify relationships about the domestication of cats.
And so when you talk about genetic markers and the genes that you can learn from say, a mummified cat, these are all mitochondrial DNA. Is that right?
Yeah. We analyzed, we had mainly the mitochondrial marker, which is a neutral marker that is transmitted from the mother to the offspring. So we see the maternal lineage, which is very nice to trace back the migrations of populations. But it does not give us a clue about the appearance or the physiology or the behavior of an animal or of cat or for human or whatever. So for that, we need to have the information of the genome, the nuclear genome. And we only analyzed one, in this particular study now, we analyzed one marker. And this is a marker that gives the coat pattern. So the wildcats are striped, so have little dots and stripes. And this is encoded by a gene that is well characterized biochemically. And if there is in this gene a mutation, a single point mutation, so which means one of the units is changed, then we change, in the cat, there is a change of the pattern from tabby striped, which is called the mackerel, because it's like a mackerel, to the blotched. And nowadays, many domestic cats have this blotched pattern, which is more the patchy type. And so, since this is a single mutation, which is well characterized and that causes this change in the pattern, we analyzed this also in all these cats that we had analyzed, in these cat remains. And we saw that this appears very late, actually, very late in the domestication process of cats. It was only at the around the 13th century that we saw it in Southwest Asia in one cat appear, and then in the Ottoman Empire to spread out. So then we have more cats in Southwest Asia and in Europe that carry this blotched pattern. So from this we can deduce that actually at the beginning, or we can hypothesize, take this as a suggestion that, or indication that cats were not really selected for specific physical markers, so that the cats, and you see that also the cat nowadays, a domestic cat, still looks pretty much like a wild cat. It is even for many cats difficult to distinguish a wild cat from a domestic cat, except you have the fancy breeds or the Persian cat or the Siam cat. So there are a few breeds. Most of them are very recent, from the 19th or 20th century, except for the Siam cat. So in the past, the cats did not change. And when you look at the iconography of Egypt or Greece or Rome, then you see that the cat really looks like our cat and looks like the wild cat. So for a long time, probably humans did not change anything about the cat. They did not select and breed the cats intentionally, because I think the cat was perfect the way it was. The cat was a small animal. It was not a dangerous animal, so you did not have to change it a lot. It had to be less shy and a little bit less aggressive so that it could live with humans. So this was a certain selection for more sociable and docile, maybe more tamed cats. And we see that in the genome as well. So in the nuclear genome of present day cats. But the cats did from the very beginning, they did what they were supposed to do. They killed rodents, they ate the rodents, they killed snakes and scorpions, so these venomous animals that were really dangerous, especially in Egypt and probably in the Levant. So these were animals that had an impact on the social life of the people in this area. And they killed all these rodents that were really, really a danger and caused a lot of economic losses, of famines, but also carried diseases. So the cat was from the very beginning a very, very useful animal. And so, and it was perfect. It didn't have to do, it didn't have to be changed in order to do what it was supposed to do. So that's my explanation why the cat is still pretty much the same as it was at the beginning compared to the dog that changed a lot. And the dogs, when you compare the dogs that we have to the wolves, you see a large variety of different shapes, of different behaviors, of different sizes. And in fact, the dog was also selected and bred for different tasks to carry out. You have the working dog, the hunting dog for birds, the hunting dog for rabbits. So different preys for different tasks. You had different breeds. And this is not the case for the cats. The cats do what they always did. They hunted rodents and birds and snakes and behave, even today, pretty much as they behaved in the past, except for the very recent time when they became really, well, I always say couch potatoes, and when they were really confined to the urban environment and to apartments. And maybe they got a bit crazy now when you look at all the internet cats.
Well, that's one really interesting part of this, is that some people, just in preparing for today's interview, even said that cats really haven't been domesticated, that they still maintain many of their wild traits and their behaviors are still that of wild cats, that they've just kind of selected themselves to be able to tolerate humans.
But this is domestication, because what changed is this behavior, and this is crucial. I mean, the wild cat is, as I said before, is a solitary animal, and the domestic cat is not. So the domestic cat likes to be with other cats. The domestic cat has no problem to be with humans, and a wild cat would not.
Well, I guess the other big question is, if you look at modern day, so extant cats, what else can we learn from DNA that tells us about the genes and tendencies, the genes that correlate or associate with tendencies of domestication? Do we understand the genetics and the genetic changes that change the behaviors of those cats?
We start to understand something about the genetic changes. We know that there is what we call the domestication syndrome. So these are genes that are involved in the development and functioning of the neural crest system, which gives the central nervous system, the brain and the nerves. And this is changed during the domestication process in all domestic animals, also in the cats. And these genes or alleles have pleiotropic effects. That means it's not only one feature that is changed, but other features can be changed just by at the same time without being selected for. For example, there are experiments were done already 30 or 50 years ago in Russia where foxes that are not domesticated so far were selected for in a fenced area, so they were kept, and only those were bred that were the most docile. And over a very short generation time, like five generations, one could already notice that the behavior had changed. But not only the behavior had changed, also the appearance had changed. So they became floppy ears, and they became spots on the fur, and this kind of changes in the appearance and the physical appearance that we know from other domestic animals as well, like dogs or cows or horses. And so there are changes that are probably first targeted on the behavior, but that have also other consequences on the physiology and the physical appearance.
Does any of that come from inbreeding, or maybe, you know, especially diseases that may be amplified as cats were brought into human control, that maybe just those kinds of breeding tendencies tended to bring out into more familiar presence?
Well, recently, yeah. Recently, there are clearly defined diseases in cats that are related to certain breeds. Yeah, this is known. There are groups that work on it. For example, Leslie Lyons in Missouri University, who is an expert on in this field. At the time, in prehistoric time, we don't know that. We don't know how this happened and whether there was any impact on disease frequency amongst cats.
So what's next for this particular line of research? Do you have additional places that you would like to investigate, or other locations where maybe you could find those types of bones to be able to do that research?
Yeah, this would be great to find this type of bones. So yeah, of course, this has to be done. We collaborate with archaeologists and archaeozoologists. So people who analyze these bones, excavate the bones, excavate the archaeological sites and excavate the bones and then analyze the bones morphologically. And these archaeozoologists then are interested in working together with us in order to get the genetic information. So what we want to do now is, of course, to get our hands on the genomes in order to tell the whole story, because now we have the story that is told from the maternal lineages and from this one nuclear marker that is the code pattern, but we would like to know more.
So in the genetic analyses of ancient DNA, is there evidence of hybridization between the wild cats and the early domestic cats, and how much interbreeding was there?
They certainly interbred, we know that. We know that even nowadays there is interbreeding between wild and domestic cat. In Europe, maybe certainly less, but in the Middle East, I think this still happens quite a lot if there are wild cats around. So we would like to see how much took place of this interbreeding, and was there a tendency in some areas more than in others, and what's the influence on the genomes that we have in modern day cats. Of course, to tell the whole process, to refine the details of the domestication process, so to know exactly at which time was the cat really tamed? Was it the ancient Egyptians? Did they start that already 2,000 years before Christ, or did they start later? This kind of refinement would be interesting to do.
And if people wanted to learn more about the research or more about your program, where would they look?
In the press, just to cat, and you will find a lot of journal articles all around. We don't have a website on that.
Okay, I guess that was my big question. So, yeah. No, very good. Thank you for joining us today.
Thank you.
And that was Professor Eva Maria Geigel from the Jacques Monod Institute in Paris, France, talking about domestication of cats and the hints that we get from the evidence that we find inside either mummified remains or other modern-day cats and how they relate to their wild antecedents. So hopefully you like this particular episode of the podcast, and if you do, please leave a review on iTunes. It really helps us have a better presence and more compelling stature in the list of growing number of podcasts, and makes us an easier choice for people who are interested in more scientific information. Write a review on iTunes, tell a friend, and share the information that we talk about here, because it's really exciting to see what we can do with modern technology to start to understand where life came from and how humans came in contact with it in the case of cats. My name's Kevin Folta. Thank you for joining, and we'll talk to you again next week.
Thank you for listening to the Talking Biotech podcast. Please send your suggestions for guests, comments, or questions to talkingbiotech@gmail.com. Please write a review on iTunes and recommend this podcast to a friend. More downloads and reviews raise the visibility of this podcast and help us reach a wider audience with science.